Blog Talk Radio.
We own this country. We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Good evening. Merry Christmas. This is our first December show in December. We're gearing up for Christmas. This is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We are very happy to be with you this evening. We're here every Wednesday evening at 7, and we're glad to be with you. We've got a full show lined up for you tonight. Joining us tonight, as usual, is Mr. Hour of Truth, Dave Court. Good evening, Dave.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Is my mic working better tonight?
It sounds pretty good right now. Yeah,
okay.
The radio intro got all screwy on us. That's probably going to sound funny because I think I was talking over it. But I know my board is all messed up. And with us for tonight, co-hosting with us, we're happy to have her with us, Miss Cindy McGee of Show Me Patriots. Hi, Cindy. How are you doing?
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Dave. How are you guys doing?
Good.
I'm doing great.
Well, good. So, we're gearing up for Christmas. I'm not anywhere near ready. My shopping's not done. Not even close. My house does look
like...
I haven't even started. My Christmas has exploded inside my house, though. The decorating is done. And it looks like Christmas exploded here. And my kids like it that way, so that's the way we do it every year. We're just moving right along. Have you guys been running into the kettle ringers and the Merry Christmasing and all of that all out there? You know, avoiding the assault on Christmas, being able to say Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas?
Yes, and I say Merry Christmas.
So do I.
So do I.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
But we're not going to surrender.
No, last year didn't seem to be as bad, and I haven't heard any reports of anybody having a problem with Merry Christmas this year, but I think we ought to make an issue of it. So, you know, we're doing the Merry Christmas thing. We have great news on our Secret Santa front. We have more than doubled our goal. So we are thrilled to death to be able to announce that. We've had a great response from the Patriot movement and a lot of generosity here in the last couple of weeks of people sending in some money. So what we're trying to do before Christmas is, Dave, what was our numbers for families? We were going to try to get 10 families or 8 families?
No, 4.
No, we originally planned for 4.
No, well, we'll try for 8.
I'm out of my mind. So are we?
I think so.
We're trying for 8?
We're trying for 4, yeah.
Oh, we're trying for 4. Do we
for
ha-
4,
did,
right.
Did we make our goal?
We did make our goal. Now, what we've had to do, we made our goal for money, but what we've had to do is we've had to adjust the number of families that we can help with that money because it's so much more expensive this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And we're going to try for 4.
Correct.
Okay. So that's awesome, which is 2 more than we had last year.
Correct.
Okay. So, and then
that's
now
fantastic.
We have a... Yeah, it's great, and I can't wait. I'm actually going to be one of the people that gets to go out and do a family this year, and I can't wait to do it. I'm going to go out to my local whatever store. I haven't decided yet, and I can't wait to go in and talk to the store manager and pick out a layaway account to be able to bestow that gift on and give those folks, you know, hopefully help them along with their Christmas. I'm really looking forward to that. Anyway, let's move right along. We've got a lot of stuff going on here tonight. We have a pretty full lineup of folks with us tonight. We're going to have Bev Perlson from the Band of Mothers. She's going to come and talk to us about the Benghazi issue. And she mentioned that she thought that there was she had some information on some gun running situations. And if you remember, Bev was with us a few weeks ago, and she was giving us an update on the possible closure of Gitmo and how were they were going to try to transfer some of those detainees to a prison right here, next door to us here in Illinois. So she may have an update on that as well. And we also have Bill Federer. We always love talking to Bill Federer. He's just so full of information. And he's going to talk to us about why he thinks the whole Benghazi issue is another fast and furious situation. So that'll kind of tie together. And he may give us a little information about Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood as well, if he has a little bit of time left over. And, of course, we'll have Ray Cuneo on with us, as we usually do, and he's going to continue to connect the dots for us with Agenda 21 and the buzzwords and that we've all been kind of glossed over, and we're going to learn to recognize those along with the Wildlands Project that's such a big part of Agenda 21. But before we get into that, you know, it's kind of there's been kind of an issue here in Missouri with the grassroots situation and everybody kind of trying to revamp since the election. We're still trying to come out of the fog and dig ourselves out of the deep darkness and despair that we've all plunged into after the election and the discouraging results. And, you know, everybody's always asking, you know, what happened? You know, what happened? Why did we fail? We had such a good results in 2010 and 2012. I mean, everything just tanked. And, you know, there are a lot of excuses. People have a lot of excuses for why we just didn't do well this election cycle. The voter turnout was supposedly bad. The messaging was wrong. There are a lot of reasons why people think that we just did not do well in this election cycle. But I think if you really look at it, I think we have to look at ourselves as a grassroots movement and look at a little deeper and see and really be honest with ourselves about what's gone wrong with the grassroots movement. And I know that Cindy and I have had this conversation several times over the last week, and we've kind of come up – I don't think that you can blame the messaging, and I don't think you can blame the voter turnout. I think that there are a lot of other reasons for the grassroots movement kind of falling by the wayside. And I think you just need to be honest about a few of those things. I've had this rant on this program before. I think we have a tendency to kind of, first of all, we haven't cast a wide enough net. You know, we're very good at communicating our issues inside the bubble, but we're not very good at communicating our issues outside the bubble and to the wider audience. And I think that has really, really hurt us. I think that we've kind of just gone down a road where, you know, we've been talking to ourselves for a couple of years, and we're just not very good at communicating the message outside the bubble. And Cindy, you and I have kind of talked about too. You know, the way we treat our elected is just not appropriate. We have an unrealistic. We treat our elected like rock stars.
I agree, Lisa. I agree. And I think, you know, and I think we've all been guilty of that. There's sort of an aura about our elected officials, and I've fallen into that trap many times over the years. And and certainly part of it is we always want to have respect for the office. Okay, that's a given. But beyond that, we don't really owe anything else. And you know, one thing that really strikes me is, I don't know about you, but I've heard more times than I care to even think about, and it's valid criticism, you know, that we haven't been there and we haven't been doing our job as citizens in being watchmen over what's happening in our government, and that is certainly true. And I don't know about you, but something that I run up against is kind of, I think that our legislators are very, very much not used to being held to account for what they do. They're not used to citizen activists who are concerned and engaged about what's going on in our government standing up and saying, no, that's not a good idea, and I would rather you do this. Now, certainly they're elected. They can do what they please. They have the pins, but at the end of the day, you know, we have the option as citizens to, number one, hold them to account, and number two, that's what the ballot box is for. And
okay,
we shouldn't be putting them up on pedestals, because
exactly.
when we do that, we do an injustice. I mean, I know several people that I would at one, you know, at one time or another, or now or whenever, consider them to be patriot candidates and patriot servants, but that doesn't mean that they get to be up on a pedestal and we're not going to hold them to account for what they do. We have to hold them to account. And the worst thing that we could do to anyone being elected to office that we support and we've gotten behind, and there are some that I've encouraged to run and helped with their campaigns and whatever, and, you know, I'm not going to stand back now and just not pay attention to what they're doing, and if I think they're doing the wrong thing, I'm going to call them on it. Because the worst thing I could do for them and for their success would be to not do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes great sense. And that passion and that fire is another thing that's kind of gone by the wayside. And I think the reason that it's gone by the wayside is because we have had a struggle from within, from people that are passionate about holding people to account to struggling with other people who are within our, supposedly within our patriot movement, who are trying to neutralize that passion, in my opinion, to tell us, you know, hey, you know, you've got to be pleasant with these, you know, well, and we'll get into that at a later time, but you guys gotta stop criticizing these legislators. You don't know
right.
what it's like to be a legislator. Well, you know, I don't need to know what it's like to be a legislator. All I know is I work to put them there, or I'm paying their salary and they work for me. And, you know, nobody is above accountability. And,
right.
you know, there's a fire still in some of the patriot movement, but it's being quashed by others in the patriot movement, whether they're patriots or lobbyists or, you know, whatever role
right.
they hold, they are
right.
out there really trying to work that issue and tell you, you know, you got to stop.
Right.
You got to stop pushing so hard. You got to stop your criticisms. You know, well, no, you don't.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
you know, you don't want to be critical for critical sake. You know, a legislator deserves recognition when they are doing the right thing, but that's
Absolutely.
All they deserve. They don't deserve
right.
any, you know, they don't deserve ticker tape parades and
right.
and adoration of worship. You know, they just deserve recognition because they are public servants.
I agree. And, you know, one thing that I don't know if you've ever attended some of the things that some of the groups put on to try and initiate people into how to interact in Jefferson City. And there's a lot of good information in those sessions, but at the same time, I think that there is a tendency to quell the enthusiasm that the citizen has, especially now. People really are engaged; they're paying attention, and but then suddenly they're told you have to jump through this hoop, that hoop, and the other hoop in order to have access to your legislator. I'm sorry, I disagree with that. Your legislator is still your legislator. Your legislator should still be willing to listen to you. And there's nothing wrong with passion and caring about what is happening to our country, our state, your county. I don't care if you're talking about mayor, city councilman, school board member, trash collector, state representative, state senator, congressman, or U.S. senator. It's they're all public servants. They ran
mm-hmm.
to be public servants. And, you know, Lisa, I ran for office as
yes.
a state representative. I lost that race. I'm fine with that. I'm perfectly happy to be a citizen activist. And so, but, you know, when I ran, I didn't expect, and it was a lot of work. It takes a lot of money. And there were great people that got behind my campaign, so forth and so on. But at the end of the day, I did not do that, and in hoping to win, I didn't expect special treatment or anything. In fact, I was really hoping for constituents to hold me accountable. And I knew sometimes that would be really uncomfortable. And I knew that I wouldn't always get it right. And I wanted to have a willing spirit to be open to whatever criticism was there, to really evaluate what was happening to do the job right.
Right. And I think we have to stop and look at just at the events over the last few days, and not just here in Missouri, but, you know, across the country. I mean, committee people in Congress, their positions are being slashed because they're not voting lockstep with leadership. You know, there are so many things. If we look back to the National Convention, we all know what happened at the National Convention to squash the voices of the conservative movement within the Republican Party. You know, we can just look at a number of incidences over the last 6 months on a state and a national level that show us that this Republican machine does not give a damn about us. The Republican machine and the establishment Republicans want to maintain their stronghold. They want to maintain their power base. And they're showing us every day that they really don't care about us.
Yes, you're right.
They really, and people should be angry about that. And if people are telling you not to be angry, if they're telling you that you need to approach this with a gentleness and a kindness, you know, beware. You have a right to be angry about those things, and you should express your anger, albeit in a respectful way, but you should be able to express that anger. And if the Tea Party and the grassroots movement does not revive that passion, I mean, we're not going anywhere. We need to stop listening to people to tell us, stop listening to those people that tell us that we have to not be passionate, not be angry about what we've got going on around us, because Rome is burning. We don't have time anymore. You know, we've got Obama back in the White House. He's going to executive order us out of everything. We have Obamacare staring at us right in the eyes, and we've got some states that have got a lot of backbone and they're standing up to it, and then we've got Missouri with a veto-proof legislature that's, while they're telling us they don't support Obamacare, I don't see a whole lot of passion or action coming out of Jefferson City trying to do anything to fight back.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, let's hope we see a change come January in that regard, because Prop C was a good baby step, but it wasn't the only step that needed to be taken, and
you know,
especially not when he got reelected.
Yeah, Prop C was nothing. Prop C was Yankee Doodle legislation.
Right. It was. At the end of the day, that's really what it turned out to be.
Yeah, I mean, and they sold it to us as the be-all, end-all savior to Obamacare at the time, and we all rallied behind it. I mean, I for one, was one of the useful idiots that got behind Prop C and supported it and campaigned for it, and it got a lot of people elected. You know, a lot of people went back to Jefferson City because of the support that Prop C garnered from the movement. A lot of Missourians voted for it, but it absolutely did nothing. And I've had this conversation with a couple of folks on the executive committee. My concern is that while you've got statements coming out of Jefferson City from legislators saying they do not support Obamacare, I'm not seeing any passion. There's no fire in the belly. And at the end of the day, what I think is going to happen is we're going to have a bunch of people saying, oh, well, you know, even though we have Prop C, there's nothing. Prop C just doesn't have the weight behind it to trump federal law, so there's nothing we can do. We're sorry.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that the Patriots need to get fired up about and be proactive and start letting their legislators know that that's not an acceptable alternative. You know, we've been fighting this battle for a couple of years pretty hardcore, and we want some folks in Jefferson City with some fire in the belly, and if we don't see it, we have the right to be angry about it and to let them know.
Absolutely. I think the first thing that a legislator is there to do is to protect our liberty and to uphold our Constitution, both our state and federal Constitution, and there needs to be passion and fire in the belly for that, because we're standing... I think we're over the cliff.
Yeah,
we're
gone.
We need somebody to put that safety net out there to hopefully catch us and break the fall. And so, and I don't mean that in a negative way or anything. I think that there's still a great deal of hope, and the Patriots have worked hard. But, you know, gird your loins. We're going in for the long haul, and this fight is not going to be pretty. And we can't afford to have any prima donnas in our legislature at any level, at any of our public servants.
Right.
Can't afford to have prima donnas. They've got to man up and get the job done. They just have to do that. And that's what we've sent them there to do.
Yeah, and if we
and when they're doing
folks,
that, I'm
going to
have their back. I will have their back 150%.
Absolutely.
But if they're failing, I'm going to be all over them like flies on honey.
Yep, we sent them there to do a job. And if we've put them on a pedestal, it's going to be that much harder to look them in the eye and telling them they're not getting the job done. So you should take the emotion, and I believe also that, and this has been a campaign technique that I think has been used for a very long time. I think they know that when they campaign, they want to make you their friend. And the minute that somebody signs up to run for office, they are no longer your friend. They want to be your public servant. They work for you. This is not personal. You have to take the emotion out of it. This is business. And you cannot be their friend. They cannot be your friend. They are your public servant, and they are your subordinate, and they work for you. And we've got to reinstill that mindset in the hearts and the minds of the patriots across Missouri, or we're going to be in a world of hurt in the next couple of years.
Right, and I think as long as our legislators are really open and receptive and listening to us, and you know that we can go in there, and they're going to listen, and take appropriate action, you know, they can certainly expect us to be behind them. And, you know, sometimes it's probably going to be kind of tough. We're going to go toe-to-toe on some things. But none of us can afford to be so thin-skinned that we just shut people off and shut them out.
Yeah.
We can't let our legislators do that to us. And I've seen that happen over the years. And it's just not appropriate. That's not what they're there for.
It's never appropriate for a legislator to shut anybody out. That's not their job.
No.
And it happens a lot. And it needs to stop.
And it's wrong. And it needs to stop. And we're in this together. And we can either work together to save this country, or we can just let it burn while we run off to put salve on our hurt feelings. And we can't do that.
Yep. It's time. The time for being nice has ended. Well, we're going to revisit this topic some more, because I truly feel that we need to leave that mindset of you know, everybody has to get along. You know, everybody doesn't have to get along. You know, we need to reestablish the pecking order. It's upside down right now, and the passions are legitimate. Rome is burning. You know, we're all in big trouble, and we've all seen in the past how fast legislation can get passed when they want it to pass.
Right.
So, or how fast measures can be taken when they want something to be done. So all those sad, tired excuses coming out of Jefferson City about how things take time, you know, or how you just can't get this done or that done without, you know, making some changes or some concessions. You know, those days are over. I think we have a veto-proof legislature this year, and, you know, the Patriots have a right to ask for what they want, and they have a right to see that – they have the right to see those results in May.
Right.
Okay, we're going to revisit
this.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say real quick, it's kind of like if my house was burning and I called the fire department and they got there and they're like, well, we think we should do this and this and this. And I say, it started here, and that's what, you know, this is where, and they're arguing, and they're trying to decide the best way to approach it and everything, while the house just stands there and burns to the ground. I mean, that's kind of where we're at with our country right now. We can't afford the luxury of that, and it's just time to take action. It's time to, you know, there are a lot of things that can be put aside to try to do what we can to push back and to prevent as much damage as possible from being done to our republic.
Yep.
And we're living in a different day and a different time, and politics as usual just isn't going to cut it.
Nope. I think this is an important topic. We're going to revisit this in the coming weeks, because I really do think that we need to get the Patriot Movement fired up again and give them back their voice and their power. So we're going to do this again next week, but right now we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with Bev Pearlson, and she's going to talk to us about Benghazi.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio.
Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
Abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve, because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
Welcome back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're here tonight with Dave and Cindy McGee. And tonight we have with us again Bev Pearlson from thebandofmothers.com. Is that right, Bev?
Yes.
BandofMothers.com. Okay, Bev was with us a couple of weeks ago, and she gave us some really interesting information about the supposed closure and the moving of Gitmo detainees to our neighborhood right next door to Illinois, right in Illinois. And she's going to give us some updates on some other issues in Benghazi, but thanks for being with us tonight, Bev.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. You guys are aware of the Senate vote. There was a Senate vote that, stopped the transfer of funds, any funding for the transfer of Gitmo detainees. And that was, I think, like one of the last weeks in November. But what's very interesting, and this just blows me away, because I'm not believing it, but I'm reading it. And I'm asking myself, what are they up to? Now, I'm going to read this to you, and it's from a report on NBC 5 Chicago News, dated November 29th. And it says, despite a study commissioned by Senator Dianne Feinstein stating American prisons could safely absorb Guantanamo Bay detainees, Senator Dick Durbin maintained Thursday that housing detainees in U.S. prisons, including Thompson Correctional Center in Illinois, is illegal.
Really?
Can you believe this one? Now, and here's what his spokesperson said. Quote, it's against the law to transfer detainees to Thompson or any other prison in the U.S., Durbin's communication director, Christina Angelera, said. Durbin is opposed to housing detainees at Thompson, and the administration has said repeatedly that they have no intention of bringing any detainees to Thompson, Illinois.
Okay, great. Where are they going to go?
Well, now, I have a theory on that, but let me just back up here. Gee, what happened between now and 2009 and 2010 when we were ferociously fighting him and Quinn and Obama on bringing the detainees to Thompson Prison?
Yeah,
you remember that, right?
The sea change, they've kind of really swallowed their or eating a little crow there on the detainee and the closing.
Well, it's
of Gitmo.
A little.
So what is it?
I don't know what it is, because it was illegal back then too, just as it is illegal today.
Well, so
but you know how those Democrats are. I mean, something can be legal today and not be legal tomorrow. You know,
yeah.
Just depends on which way the wind blows, I guess.
Legal is
when you're a Democrat,
term.
Right? But Congressman Hoekstra, I mentioned to you that he really was wonderful when we were fighting the transfer or the alleged, transfer of the detainees back in 2009. He gave me a lot of good information, and the reason he was so knowledgeable about it was before they had planned on dumping these butchers in Thompson, Illinois, they were going to transfer them to Standish, Michigan, to a prison there. And he was a congressman there from Michigan. So he got involved. He also sat on the House Intelligence Committee. So he knew everything about this issue, and he knew all about these worst of the worst terrorists. So one of the things he said to me back when just a couple months ago they came up with the money to, you know, the feds bought Thompson. I was, you know, I was terrified and I was outraged, and I said to him, what are they doing? And I mean, they've thwarted the rule of law. They've gone around the Appropriations Committee and managed, and they went to Holder and said, hey, get us some of that prison money, and that's who came up with the money. So, you know, of course, we were all outraged about it. And, you know, he says, I said to him, well, you know, Holder's been on record saying they're not bringing the Gitmo detainees to Thompson. And he said, well, then maybe what they're going to do is empty out another prison and put those prisoners in Thompson. And then voila, now they have an empty prison. But also remember, they don't really need to do that because from what I understand, there's 4 empty prisons now. So I don't know what they're up to. I really don't. I'm absolutely shocked. And, you know, I'm waiting for Fox or somebody to come out. This is outrageous that he even made this statement. You mean it's now just occurred to him that it's illegal to transfer these terrorists here? He just realized that now?
Yeah, do you think that? Well, obviously somebody's had a change of heart about something. I mean, they obviously don't want to close
it down. I don't trust them for a minute. I don't know what's going on. And with Dick Durbin, I always try to read between the lines. And you have to remember one thing. Now, he did not, that's not his quote. That's his spokesperson's quote. So let's remember that, too. Those words did not come out of his mouth. They came out of his communication director's mouth. You know, so who knows? Next week she may be gone. And he can say, I never said that. She said it, but I didn't say it. So, you know, that's, I don't know what to make of it. I really don't. But maybe right now they don't want any of us focusing on this because of Feinstein's report. So they're, you know, it's a distraction. You know, they're really good at this. Let's distract them over here. Let them think that we've forgotten about this. I don't believe for a minute that Obama's going to stop. And I truly do believe, my own feeling is, the reason Holder is staying on, this is his whole mission, is to get the detainees here. And then he can leave.
Once they get on American soil, the laws change about how you can prosecute.
Oh, it's a mess. It's a mess. And when Feinstein said, oh, well, it'll save us $114 million a year. Hey, I've got a great idea. How about this, Lisa? You know what would save us $4 million this month if Obama gave up that Hawaiian vacation? How about that? That's $4 million right now. Bam. You know, now.
I don't know what your problem is, Bev. What's $4 million when we're $16 trillion in debt?
I know. What is wrong with me? I mean, that's nothing, you know. It's hilarious, isn't it? It's just, I mean, the numbers just roll off people. You know, I love this, you know, $16 trillion here. And, I mean, it just blows my mind. It really does. Almost, you know, you have to laugh to keep from crying.
And
lately I try to do a lot of laughing, I mean, because that's how ridiculous it's all getting to me. It is. And I have faith. I do have faith in the American people. I have faith in Americans. And, you know, I'm not going to get myself worked up about this because it's the biggest show I've ever seen. And I'm bored. I'm bored to death. And if I hear one more person say, how about this expression, pay your fair share.
Oh, there you go. What's
if I hear one more person say that, I'm going to scream.
Well, you know, I mean, with all of the cuts that they're about to make in military spending, you know, here we go. So, you know, it's 6 to 1, half dozen of the other. So let's talk a little bit about Benghazi. What have you got for me on the Benghazi issue?
Okay, on the Benghazi, you know, I'll share with you. I kind of already did, but I'll share it with your audience. You know, I was on a road trip the last couple of months, and I had the honor of having dinner with a retired CIA agent, and I can't divulge his name, but he's you see him on Fox a lot. He's got quite a reputation. Did a lot of missions, just stellar reputation. And what he shared with us that evening about Benghazi, and this is when it was maybe a month after it all went down. Basically, he said that what everybody was going to end up finding out was that what they were actually doing in Benghazi is running guns through there, mm-hmm. up to the rebels. Now, you know, once again, you know, we've managed to distract. I mean, this is absolutely the administration of distraction, you know. This is what they do really well, and they've managed to distract, and this is what they do. So, you know, Fast and Furious, we've now have people actually, you know, taking the fall for Holder and Obama. Let's be honest about that. That's what happened there.
Right.
And I'm hoping, I hope and pray every day, and thank God for whistleblowers, but I hope and pray every night, every day, that some of these guys are going to speak up about the truth of what's really gone on. But I understand when they don't.
Well, the
I really
news has
do.
Been awfully quiet the last week or so. There's not been much in the news about it. And all of the questioning and all of the, you know, all of the investigation just seems to kind of come to a dead halt.
Well, Clapper was testified today in the Benghazi mess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's what was new about that, really? I you know, Susan Rice is, she's under the bus, I think. I don't think he'll nominate her. But we have four dead Americans. And do you remember him standing up there talking about how, you know, we were going to find justice and we were going to get justice? And, you know, as far as I know, from what I understand, they haven't even secured that compound there, that embassy building.
You know, and that's just another issue. Cindy and I were talking earlier before you came on about, you know, the Patriots need to start asking. I mean, you know, the fire needs to erupt. You know, we've got four dead Americans. You know, we know that Obama, there was a stand down order given, and these people died when they were asking for help, and they were denied help that they were asked for, and everything's kind of fallen apart. You know, where's the outrage? You know, we're all just kind of sitting back, and it's like, you know, there's. Treason. I mean, the only word that comes to mind is treason.
Well, it's like, which ball do you grab that's in the air?
There's so
think
much.
About it. I mean, and this is, you know, we all know about Saul Alinsky's rules for radicals, but this is really the art of distraction at its best. I thought the Clintons were good,
mm-hmm.
but you know, I have a friend, Marinka Peshman. She wrote this book, The Whistleblower, and her whole premise of her book, and it's about the Clintons. But she makes the statement that the Obama administration is the Clinton administration on steroids.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, I mean, and that's, I'd say that's a very accurate statement.
That sums it up entirely. I mean, I never thought that what I saw go on in the Clinton administration, I never thought we'd ever see another administration like that. These people have taken it to a whole new level. I mean, it's just... It's sad. I feel really bad for our troops. They're in a hell of a mess over there in Afghanistan. I feel really bad for the families of the four Americans that were murdered. I feel really bad for General Hamm, who actually stood up to them and said, screw you on standing down the order. I'm on my way. And he was immediately relieved from duty. Whatever happened to poor General Hamm? Well,
right.
From what I understand, they've retired him. Well, there's a general who truly stood for what a general, unlike General Petraeus. He went to defend his men. That's what he went to do. And now he's retired.
Yeah. Just get rid of him.
This is what happens. And this is what, if you think back, isn't this what happened in the Clinton administration?
Yeah.
You should have my friend Marinka on, boy, and let her talk about her book. She just finished another book on Vince Foster's, the death of Vince Foster. It's called Following Orders.
Oh, we'd love to have her. Send
yeah,
her
you,
re-
you should. I mean, but she can go into more detail about the Clintons and now, you know, and really she makes another good point that all of the same players that served in the Clinton White House are up there right now.
Yeah, it's not a lot. There's not much difference.
There
and
isn't.
The agenda's the same, but it's just running a little faster.
It's faster. I mean, I just, I mean.
The bullet train.
Talk about, I they're doing so many things that I see as illegal. But what happened here in Benghazi, this is sad. It's very, very sad. And I don't understand why people aren't outraged. But you know what? We lose soldiers, and I don't ever see people raising flags. You know, I don't see the flags raised over the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our troops were getting murdered, like, you know, just at such a rate, you know, over the summer. And nobody was talking about that. It infuriates me. It's sad.
Yeah.
But you know what? If I could just say this to your audience, you know, say a prayer for our troops. I mean, I know there's a lot going on in Washington, but we've got guys over there right now risking their lives for all of us. And, you know, there's so many good organizations out there that, you know, if your listeners would, you know, send a care package or make a donation, there's a lot of good, solid organizations that, you know, really all they do is all the money they collect goes to the troops.
Absolutely. So we give them to let our troops know, especially this time of year, that we're still
right.
thinking of them, and we appreciate what they do.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, thank you,
I mean,
Beth.
And you know what, Lisa, you don't hear, you know what, that's one thing that he has managed to do so well up there, Obama. He has so distracted the American people. I never, ever hear anybody talking about the troops right now. I can't tell you the last time I heard somebody talking about them. And so everybody needs to realize, with all this nuttiness going on, we've got guys over there that are risking their lives for us. And, you know, we all need to pray for them and think about them, because there's not a day goes by they don't think of us.
That's
you know?
Right. That's right.
So,
and their sacrifice is much greater.
It is. Yes. It really is. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, Bev. We appreciate it. Go to thebandofmothers.com and read the latest updates. Bev will keep you updated on all that's going on, and we appreciate it. We hope you'll come back soon. Thanks, Bev.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's take a break. We'll be back.
This is the Grassroots Minute. Today, Congresswoman Joanne Emerson announced she will leave her congressional post in February to become president and CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association after just being reelected last month for a ninth term in Missouri's 8th District. In a statement, Emerson said, "I'm not leaving Congress because I've lost my heart for service." Oh, really? Now you're sticking it to the taxpayers once more and having to pay for a special election that will be set by the governor. And you're also not giving the voters a choice of picking your replacement. That will be done by the special interest-controlled 8th District Congressional Republican Committee. Some of the names being battered about to replace you are Lloyd Smith, Missouri Republican Party Executive Director, former State Treasurer Sarah Steelman, 8th Congressional District Committee Chair Eddie Justice, and don't forget Kevin Shoot Those Who Litter Engler, who just dropped down from the state Senate to a state representative position. Bob Parker, the Patriot-supported candidate who lost to Emerson in the August primary, said Monday he would be looking real hard at whether he would seek the nomination. "I've had several calls this morning from people wanting me to run again," he said. "I think we desperately need to have some conservative representation in Congress and people that are fiscally responsible and want to follow the Constitution." Parker said he will officially announce the decision within the next few days. He called Emerson's decision to leave Congress interesting. "It does come as a big surprise to me," he said, "that she would retire just at the beginning of her next term." "Well, Bob, you have our support, but it doesn't surprise us in the least bit that she would thumb her nose at the voters once more." I'm Terry Varner for the Grassroots Minute.
I've got a feeling that the night is
turning. Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
That Terry Varner calls him like he sees him in those Grassroots Minutes. He's not pulling any punches, and thank goodness for that. And he's right on the money with that issue, that whole situation with that resignation this week just set me on fire. That's another situation of the Republican establishment machine sticking it to the folks. You know, there's just that's just an outrageous example of manipulating the system and not doing right by the citizens. So, if you get a chance to get in to do some research on Bob Parker, he's a very good constitutional conservative candidate. He's got a great website. Go out there and Google his website and educate yourself on him. If you're not familiar with him from other parts of the state, give him a look. And call your committee man and committee woman and tell them that you support Bob Parker. Okay, the last few weeks, we all know that we've had Ray Cuneo on in the last few weeks, and he's done an excellent job in outlining issues with Agenda 21. Agenda 21 has been a situation, a subject, an issue that has been going on for literally generations now, decades. The past, you know, several presidents have been propping this issue up, and it's like the silent killer. It's been right under our nose. It's been creeping up and getting a stranglehold on our liberties, and we don't even know it. And thank goodness that Glenn Beck has finally he's released co-published a book and just released it in the last couple of weeks, which has brought a great deal of attention to this issue where otherwise people would not have known about it. So, and we here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition have been trying to bring some attention to it over the last few weeks, and Ray Cuneo has been helping us do that. So he has done a great job of outlining the buzzwords that are attached to Agenda 21 that we've been hearing for a very long time, and not really understanding how they affect us. And I had an opportunity to talk to Ray earlier this week, and he is going to connect the dots between some of those buzzwords and the Wildlands Project. Let's take a listen.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio, and we're back again with Ray Cuneo. We have been discussing the buzzwords that help you identify Agenda 21 issues in your local communities, and we've kind of identified a few of those specific topics, and we're going to go into some detail on those. We have been talking very much about the Wildlands Project and how that works with Agenda 21, and we have Ray here again with us. Thanks for being with us, Ray, to tell us a little bit.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, to tell us a little bit more about the specifics of how these things are being implemented in your community. So, Ray, you know, Glenn Beck, like we noted last week, Glenn Beck has released a book which is helping to kind of spread the word and bring more attention to Agenda 21. And you have, the last many weeks on this show, been giving us details about how that's being implemented. But those buzzwords are really important for people to identify with because it's going on all around them. It's everywhere. So tell us some things that you've flagged for us this week, and let's go into some detail there.
Well, you know, Lisa, to start off with, as I said on a lot of the other segments, I kind of divide my thinking, and this is along the lines of Agenda 21, not only at the international UN level, but in the United States, in terms of land and resource and people, in terms of rural versus urban. Now, in the urban areas, we've been referring to Agenda 21, which the current buzzword is smart growth or new urbanization. In the rural areas, we've been talking about the Wildlands Project and its goal. And today I'd kind of like to, we've touched on some of the implementation aspects of the Wildlands Project, but it's a massive amount of detail there in terms of how the federal government wants to get control of these lands that comprise so much of the geographical area of the United States. And, you know, there's things that are happening right now in terms of new regulations that are coming down the pike from the federal government along with the state, their state counterparts, the land and resource agencies. But there's also a lot of previous legislation that was passed here in the United States back in the 70s that is being used by the proponents of Agenda 21 and the proponents of the Wildlands Project to accomplish their end. And what I'd like to dwell on a little bit more is the three predominant federal laws, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the Clean Air Act. Now, all three of those will have an impact on people, regardless in land use, resource use, and people's activities, regardless where you live in the United States, in the urban areas or in the rural areas. But it's really going to have a impact on the rural areas. And it will be those three pieces of legislation have been usurped and twisted at the regulatory level, meaning the EPA and the Corps of Engineers and U.S. Fish and Wildlife and all these land and resource agencies at the federal and state level, to accomplish the goals of Agenda 21 and the Wildlands Project. Now, one thing I would point out, again, to just run over a number here so people get a grasp of what we're talking about in terms of land use area. The lower United States is roughly, and I think I've quoted this before, roughly 2 billion acres in land area. And roughly, according to the USDA's, and these are kind of outdated figures, but I still think your listeners will get the point. According to USDA, and these are around 2000, I believe, year 2000 figures, 5% of that 2 billion acres was considered developed. So 5% would be roughly 100 million acres. Well, let's just go through the benefit of the doubt, say it rounded off at 10%, to be generous, because maybe there's been some growth in the last decade or so. Maybe, maybe not. But let's say it's 200 million acres. And the point I'm trying to make here is for people to understand, you know, the proponents of Agenda 21 say that we're running out of land. We're developing too much. We're losing all our resources. We're losing nature, et cetera, et cetera. Well, 200 million acres is roughly 10% of that 2 billion. Now, to give some perspective to this, 200 million acres is roughly half the land area of the state of Missouri that is considered developed. Half the land area of the state of Missouri. State of Missouri, I believe, in terms of acres, is about 350 million acres. So if you condensed all the development in the United States and say that we're developing everything, we're pouring concrete over everything, if you just condensed everything from all 48 states into the lower 48 into one area, it would be the size of roughly half the area of the state of Missouri. So my point in all this is that we have vast amounts of open space in the United States, but people are being led to believe that we're running out of resources. We're running out of open space. If we don't do something, if we don't turn this over to the federal government along the blueprint lines of the UN to go in and establish this wildlands project and drive people out of these rural areas and into these urban areas of high density development, stack them up, as we said, and stack and pack population. But in the rural areas, we have a tremendous amount of open space. Now, back to the three pieces of legislation, and there's many other things that are being done, don't get me wrong, that will assist the proponents in trying to drive people out of the rural areas over a long period of time. But let's just take the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act, was, as well as the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Air Act, came out of the early 70s. They were well-intentioned pieces of legislation to protect the environment, to protect endangered species, protect air and water. Having said that, the regulatory agencies, particularly after the advent of Agenda 21 in the early 90s here in the United States, saw an opportunity to ignore the original legislative intent of those acts and move forward with very restrictive regulations. And they're getting more so all the time. It's getting to the point where if you live in rural America, the Endangered Species Act is a constant threat. The Clean Water Act is a constant threat. Even the Clean Air Act Cleaner Act, maybe a little more so in the city areas. Now, let me make the point here. We all want to take care of our environment. That's not the issue. That's not the issue. We can take care of it without having a government that is just so restrictive as though it's a completely socialist state. But in regards to the Clean Water Act, the Clean Water Act was originally written to accommodate what they call point source pollution, meaning factories and cities that were dumping into streams, like we've heard up in Cleveland, the river up there, Cuyahoga, I believe it was, that would burn, could burn the oil slicks off of the water. Well, those things, that was all appropriate. And the Clean Water Act, supposedly, at the time that it was written, or in fact, when the time was written, pertained to navigable waters, commercially navigable waters of the United States. Right in our own backyard, of course, we've got the Missouri River and the Mississippi River and the Lower Gatineau and the Lower Osage, so on. But as time went on, the regulatory agencies, we had regulatory creep to where these agencies went and really expanded their jurisdiction by rewriting the regs all the way up all of the tributaries, even small streams, creeks, and so on, to the point where without congressional approval, they were really laying claim, they meaning the Corps of Engineers and EPA, who was the two lead agencies on the Clean Water Act, were laying claim to water right up to your drain pipe. Now, they were doing this, and they got EPA and the Corps of Engineers got into a couple of court battles in the, I think it was 2003, 2004, sometime in that time frame, and they lost. They lost their effort. But they, as government is doing, or the executive branch is doing so well these days, they just completely ignore what Congress wants by rewriting the regs to ignore their original legislative intent. They ignored the court rulings, and they still went ahead in implementing these regs. Well, in 2010, with the Obama administration, and of course in 2009-10, he had both houses of Congress, and there was a push then to get it codified into statutory law at the federal level, the Clean Water Restoration Act. Now, here's where we're getting to the bottom line of what they wanted to accomplish. Had that went into effect, it would have given legitimacy in federal law. Action that they are already taking. But the fact of the matter is, what it would have said that the waters of the United States, every drop of water, and I think we've covered this a bit before, every drop of water in the United States, in your bird bath, in the stream behind your house, in the Missouri River, regardless of where it's at, in a wetland, is waters of the United States. No one will control any water, public or private. It'll all be federally controlled and owned. And the use thereof, or any degradation thereof, will be addressed by the federal government. Now, what is interesting is this includes, as I pointed out before, not only point source, factories and cities dumping in, which they should monitor that and control it, but also what they call potential non-point polluters, meaning anybody that lives in this vast area of the United States that's all rural, and you got many, many millions and millions, hundreds of millions, well, billions of acres out here that the federal government is now saying we control that water regardless of where it is, and we consider the possibility that any human activity in any of the rural America could be a potential threat to our clean water. So, in the way this Clean Water Restoration Act was written, and fortunately it didn't pass, but it came very close in the waning hours of that Congress. But had it passed, not only would the United States had statutory control of all waters, but it would have had also, it specifically said that the federal government could control any land use activity, any place in the United States that may have a detrimental effect on said waters. So the reason I dwell on this Clean Water Act, and we can go into the Endangered Species Act, we've touched on that before in the Clean Air Act, but that Clean Water Act touches everything. And I've said for years that water would be the ultimate tool that the federal government would use in controlling land use, resource use in the United States. And, of course, as we said before, when you control land, you control people and you control their activities and behavior. So, as it stands today, that act did not become statutory law at the federal level. However, with the Obama administration and Lisa Jackson running the EPA, they just pretty much thumbed their nose at the courts. And we've covered this with the courts and Congress. Congress has lost complete oversight over these regulatory agencies. Occasionally, Congress, you know, they're so bogged down in so many other things, not that those aren't important, but Congress will occasionally give lip service about, yeah, we should be watching this agency or that agency in terms of what are they doing to abuse the Clean Water Act or whatever, beyond what Congress's original intent was. And that's important for people to understand. If we're a country of laws and they're made, they originate there in Congress, then these regulatory agencies, it is the job of Congress to ride regulatory roughshod over these agencies to make sure they stay in line with the original intent. And so that Clean Water Act and so many other pieces of legislation that are impacting our lives, and you and I briefly touched on education earlier in our conversation, whether it's education or land use or whatever, these federal agencies just really, like they said, thumb their nose at the at Congress many times, and even the courts, and they go on.
That's right. There's no accountability. We've talked to Darren Morley of Reboot Congress recently, but Lisa Jackson of the EPA has initiated or developed sock puppet emails, I think, to avoid Freedom of Information Act requests from various entities about the goings on in the EPA. So we absolutely know that, you know, they're not being held to account. And, you know, when you're not being held to account, you know, it just gives you the opportunity for these behaviors to just continue, you know, and then slow, and to use a term that you've used here so many times before, we're being slow boiled and we don't even know it.
Well, that's right. And the sad part about it is I don't know how we get this balance of power back in our government. The check and balance is what I'm trying to say. Check and balance, because right now, the way I perceive it, and Clinton was really bad at this, too, on these issues here of Agenda 21. Like I've said before, you know, he was, Paul Begala, one of his aides, said, you know, executive order, law of the land, kind of cool. That was an exact quote. Well, that's pretty much what Obama's doing here, whether it's an executive order, presidential proclamation, presidential initiative, whatever. He just has given full range to the federal agencies to carry forward with implementing all these aspects of Agenda 21. And who's going to – and I think the approach is he's narcissistic enough, I believe, that he believes that who's going to stop me.
Right. Well, nobody is stopping him. There's
yeah,
nobody
who's
going to
stop me, even the Supreme Court. Well, what is the Supreme Court going to do? The nine judges or any of the prevailing judges, are they going to walk down to the end of – down to the White House and say, you can't do that? But who is going to stop? And we have a constitutional monarchy here. I mean, that's the way this government is being run. And every day, particularly now that the elections are over, these federal agencies just feel like they've got all the rope they need, and they're going to carry forward with no fear of Congress. And, of course, Congress is so tangled up itself right now over all these – fiscal cliff issues and what have you, and kicking the can down the road, and this whole debt crisis. Nobody's even looking at what these federal agencies are doing out here to destroy our Constitution and destroy people's rights. But one point I'd like to really, really emphasize here is that, look, 80% of the American people live in what is considered an urban area, 20% in rural America. But what happens in rural America with this Wildlands Project and the ultimate goal of that to drive people out of there is going to have a serious negative impact not only on that 20% that lives in rural America, but all of the people in the United States. And a lot of people don't understand how important what happens in rural America is to your life if you live in downtown St. Louis or Chicago or San Francisco or New York. Because that's where the coal comes from. That's where the natural gas comes from. That's where the timber comes from, and our food production and so on. So it's vitally important that people who live in these urban areas understand the threat to this whole rural landscape. And the Wildlands Project, again, to cover for people, is the ultimate goal is to rewild 50% of the land area of the lower 48 United States, which would be roughly 100 billion acres. I'm sorry, a billion acres, not 100 billion. 1 billion acres, which, when I say rewild, over a period of time, meaning 50 years, ultimately to drive people out, drive all human use out, no more wise multiple use, meaning resource or timbering or mining or anything like that for the benefit of the American people, and turn it back over to a pre-Columbian, pre-Columbus days
wilderness
type landscape.
Well, I mean, and it's perfect. I mean, if you stack and pack the folks in the stack and pack urban areas, you've got them all contained, and then you've got their food sources and their water sources from the wildlands areas controlled where they can't get access to any of that. The government controls that, so you've got people contained, and then you've got control of their food and their water because they're not allowed to produce it on their own. It's the perfect plan.
Well, and the goal is, you know, the goal is, and I was just rereading this over again. I mentioned, I think in one of our last, I don't know if it was the last segment or the one before that, about where we covered what went on down in Rio de Janeiro at the UN. And under this new scenario of Green World Order, which is the same thing as saying sustainable development. But I just read again from that report that they issued. Every aspect of human life, lifestyles, opinions, behavior, education, health, consumption, production, agriculture, diet, law, taxation, industry, governance, and more would be reshaped, conformed to international standards. Now, folks, you got to listen. I know people listen to the news, and just think of what I just said there, and remember that the next time you listen to the news and all of these issues that are going on in terms of agriculture and government controlling production, controlling consumption, controlling health. Look at the big health issue. Look at the education.
So
the goal here is government wants to control, be the ultimate dispenser of rights. They want to say what is sustainable and what isn't sustainable.
Socialism to the largest degree that you can have it. At some point in the future, Ray, I would like to talk about some of the education issues, because this is all about conditioning folks, and they've done a very good job of getting into our educational system, and over the last several decades and generations, they have been conditioning us to think a certain way, you know, to go along with the program. You know, there are a lot of buzzwords in this list on the Glenn Beck Agenda 21 book, you know, Common Core Curriculum, International Baccalaureate. There are a lot of things that talk about it, the education issue. So at some point I'd like to focus on how we're all being conditioned to march to the tune and you know, and to just kind of ignore all of these red flags that have been going up around us forever.
Well, and again, there, if people just open their eyes, there are so many red flags there, so many red flags that we see every day.
Absolutely. Okay, thanks for being with us this week, Ray. We really appreciate it. We're going to get back with you again next week or the week after, and hopefully talk a little bit more about some of these buzzwords and focus in on some of these other aspects of how we're being sucked into Agenda 21.
Great. Well, you enjoy the warm climate change day.
Yeah, thank you. You too, Ray. Have a good day.
Okay, bye. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye.
You better not pout, I'm telling you why.
Here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, it's Christmas in July and August and September. Last year on Christmas Eve, MGC paid off the department store layaway accounts of two Missouri families who were not able to provide Christmas for their children. This year, we would like to at least double that number, and in an attempt to do that by the holiday season, we're asking you to consider donating a few dollars toward that effort. We know the holiday season is the most difficult time of year to ask for donations, so we're planning ahead and asking you to give whatever you can so that a few Missouri families will be able to celebrate at Christmas. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and look for the Secret Santa page. All the details are there for you to donate by PayPal, check, or money order. Conservatives have proven to be the most generous and most benevolent people in the United States. Please help us with this very small charitable project.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Welcome back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour. And we are back with us, as we've promised. We have Bill Federer with us tonight to talk a little bit more about the Benghazi issue and to give us some of his insight. Bill's probably got more information stored in his head on the Middle East and the culture there and all of the details that go along with it than anybody on earth. Thanks for being with us tonight, Bill.
Lisa, great to be with you.
So, we've all been watching with great interest the issues of just prior to the election and post-election, the issues of Benghazi, just appalled at how things have taken place there. Can you give us a little bit of insight? You and I have conversed by email a little bit earlier this week. You kind of feel that some of this Benghazi issue is kind of a fast and furious deja vu.
Well, it does have some instances that look like a Saul Alinsky, Karl Marx, Machiavelli type of strategy. What do I mean by that? Our founders, I wrote a book, it's called Change to Chains, and it's a 6,000-year quest for global control. So I go through the very beginnings of recorded human civilization, about 3,000 or 4,000 BC, are when the first human records were ever written down. Egyptian hieroglyphics, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley. Well, from that time till now, about 6,000 years, there's been dictatorships. That is the most common form of government in world history. Sort of a default setting for human government is dictatorship. You get a bunch of people around, and one of them winds up being the bully. And so we call them different names, pharaohs, caesars, kaisers, sultans, czars. What is rare in history is people getting a chance to rule themselves without a king. Israel under the judges, but the rubber band snaps back, and they decide they want a king. Athens had a democracy for a couple hundred years till they were conquered by Alexander the Great's dad. Rome was a republic until Julius Caesar made himself dictator for life and the rubber band snapped back. And I go through all these instances till we come up with King George III. Now, the British Empire was the most powerful empire that planet Earth had seen, 13 million square miles, a half a billion people. They eventually had all of India, which is a quarter of the world's population. But America's founders wanted to do the opposite. They did not like the king appointing all the judges, and they decided that he was right and they were wrong. They didn't like him blockading their harbors and siding the natives of the frontiers. In other words, they wanted to go to the other extreme. So they took the power of a king and separated it into three branches, separated federal to state level, and then tied up this new federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs. All our Constitution really is a bunch of hurdles to prevent power from reconcentrating back into the hands of a dictator. That's the gravitational pull. And we're like the satellite up in space, and every now and then we have a booster revival to try to keep our freedoms independent. But this gravity wants to pull power to Washington. It wants to concentrate power. And, again, this has happened over 6,000 years. And so there's a whole set of philosophers that talk about how do you take separated power and reconcentrate it. And the reason I go into that is because you can understand the president's actions when you see it from this point of view. 500 years ago in Italy, now Italy was not Italy 500 years ago, it was a bunch of city-states. Venice, Genoa, Naples, Florence, Siena, they all had armies and navies and fought. And there was a guy named Machiavelli, and he thought if one prince could control all of the Italian city-states, there would stop this infighting and it would be peaceful. So he figured his end was so good that any means necessary to get there is justified. So he wrote a book called The Prince, where he advocated the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end that you can do anything you want to get there. So lie, cheat, steal. So here's a scenario. The prince wants to conquer a city. The city does not want to be conquered. They would hate the prince. But if this prince pays criminals to kill cows, burn barns, and create crisis and terror, the people would cry out for help. The prince would come in and kill the very criminals that he bribed. Nobody would know the better for it, and they would praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire, and then you go around the front of the house and solve a fire extinguisher. And they'll pay anything for it and thank you for being there. So it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control.
Oh, my God.
This has been going on for 500 years, and everybody in politics, like Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste. You know, Bill Clinton used to quote Machiavelli. Anyway, Machiavelli inspired someone named Hegel. George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel lived in Germany in the 1820s. He has a special impact on Missouri. You think, what? Well, in Germany, after Napoleon invaded, the Prussian response was that we need to have a strong state to keep Napoleon and any future dictator out. And so it devolved into this idea that the state is all important. And, you know, King Frederick of Prussia got, you know, Hegel and these different guys to come. And so they came up with this idea that that the state is all-powerful. Hegel said, it's called rationalism, nothing's real unless it's provable, and he could not prove God, so he said God's not real, and he said if there is no God, that there is no eternal life, and he said the closest you can come to eternal life is to create something that will exist after you're dead. You know, so like the Greek idea of building a statue, and if they remember you, well, that's at least better than nothing, but that's the closest you can come. And so Hegel said that instead, rather than a statue, he says the best thing you can create is a government. And so he said the highest purpose of humanity is to create and perpetuate big government. So this state worship is your highest purpose in life is to serve the state. You exist for the state's benefit. Now, we know in Prussia that turned into the Weimar Republic, that turned into the Nazi Germany, that turned into that state worship. But during this early 1820s period, a bunch of German immigrants came to America, came to Missouri, and Missouri became a state. And what did Missouri choose as its state motto? We are the show-me state. Mm-hmm. Nothing's real unless it's provable. This is Hegelian dialectics. I mean, Hegelian rationalism. If you get a Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedia and you look up Hegel, it'll say Hegelianism, the St. Louis movement. So a bunch of these German immigrants were coming over and said, nothing's real unless it's provable. Hegel came up with a theory called dialectics, Hegelian dialectics. And it sounds complicated, but it's not. It's a triangle. One corner is a thesis. The opposite corner is an antithesis or antithesis. and the top corner is a synthesis. And so you start off at the thesis, the first corner, and you create the antithesis. You create the opposite. And then, so in other words, you create a problem that's real bad, and then everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad, the synthesis.
So
Hegelianism is basically you create real bad problems, and everybody's happy to settle for the answer that's half as bad. And so this influenced Karl Marx, and Karl Marx applied Hegelian dialectics to politics. And he said, okay, how do you change governments? He says, well, you send community organizers and labor organizers into a country to create an antithesis, to create a crisis. And he said, how do you do it? Well, you find the have-nots. You find the people that feel slighted, that they're left out of the political process, they are poor, they're down on their luck, and you play upon their lust. And you say, you want what the other ones have, follow me, you'll get it. And it works best if the people are not religious. I mean, even Napoleon said religion is what keeps the poor from murdering the rich. So if you can get rid of religion, then these people are just can be ruled by their passions. So you go to a bunch of these poor, unintelligent people and say, look, you want what they have, follow me, you'll get it. And then you stir them into riots and crisis. And when there's blood in the streets and neighbors are being killed, everybody is happy to have the order restored, and they don't care if there's a dictator that does it. And so 45 countries fell to communism this way. They would send in their labor organizers and community organizers, and they would organize the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners. They'd organize the poor against the rich, the Muslims against the Christians, the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo, you know, the Catholics against the Protestants. They really did not care who the two sides were or what the issues were. Their goal was to destabilize the system, to bring it down, to create a crisis. And then in the confusion and the killing, everybody's happy for this synthesis. They're happy for somebody to restore some kind of order. But in the process, they've just given up their freedoms into the hands of a dictator. And so, again, 45 countries fell to communism this way, and communism is nothing more than dictatorship. Every communist country has a communist dictator: Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Castro, Kim Jong-il, Putin, whoever you want to call. And so we see that this Machiavelli, this Hegel, this Karl Marx influenced Lenin. Lenin said, well, what you do to create this crisis, he says, you have to grind the middle class out of existence through the two millstones of taxation and inflation. So you tax them, and then what they've hidden away, you inflate the currency, so what they have stashed is now worthless, and then you take over. Stalin said crises are necessary for the government to demand and obtain total submission of all citizens. I mean, Stalin was so bad. There was a he wanted another crisis so that he can consolidate more power. And there was a Tea Party movement starting in the Soviet Union. It was called the Anti-Stalinists. And he was scratching his head thinking, how can I get rid of these anti-Stalinists? And then he had an idea. Stalin had a supporter named Sergei Kirov, who loved Stalin and would give these great speeches praising Stalin as the liberator of the workers of the world. But he was getting a little bit too popular, and so Stalin had an idea. He would assassinate his friend, Sergei Kirov, and blame it on the anti-Stalinists. Nobody would suspect him because they're buddies, and the anti-Stalinists didn't like him to begin with, so everybody would say, oh, yeah. And so he used that as an excuse to kill millions. So Stalin had to create crises. Even Castro said that the revolution needs for its development the antithesis, the people starting the crises. Anyway, this influenced someone named Saul Alinsky. Now, Saul Alinsky was a community organizer in Chicago. He apprenticed by driving around with Al Capone's hitmen. He was really impressed that all you'd need to do is a little terror and crisis in a neighborhood, and the whole neighborhood would fold and submit to the gang and, you know, would pay them their protection money and so forth. And so Saul Alinsky decided to apply this to politics. And he said a community organizer's job is to create the issues. community organizer, seeks out problems rather than avoiding them. He must rub raw the resentments of the community to the point of overt expression. The community organizer must fan the flames of hostility. He must seek out controversy, because unless there is controversy, the people are not motivated enough to act. And so Hillary Clinton wrote her master's thesis on Saul Alinsky, and our current president taught Saul Alinsky's community organizing tactics when he was in Chicago. And when he was working for Acorn, and how Acorn would go into the offices of the banks and force them to lend money to poor neighborhoods and bring the banks down. And then the banks said, well, what do we do? And then the federal government decided, well, we'll buy those worthless loans. And then so that caused basically the whole subprime mortgage crisis. But this idea... So we have a president who is a master at creating and capitalizing on crisis to consolidate control. A matter of fact, his campaign manager is David Axelrod, who said on NPR Radio, April 2010, he said, in Chicago politics, we have a tradition where you throw a brick through your own campaign office window and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent. In other words, you create the crisis, and then you blame it on the other guy. In other words, you tank the economy on purpose, and then you blame it on the rich people. And so I use the idea of fast and furious. Now, if people are not familiar with that, this is a situation where our attorney general is held in contempt of Congress. In other words, he should be in jail right now for contempt of Congress. Why is our attorney general, Eric Holder, held in contempt of Congress? It's called fast and furious. This is where evidence has shown that our government was supplying guns to the drug gangs in Mexico. Now, why would they do that? Well, they wanted to create a crisis that involved American guns. And so they could come along and say, gee, there's crisis with American guns. Somehow these drug gangs are getting American guns. We need to register and limit American guns. Somebody in our country's giving them to them. We need to shut down these gun trade shows and these gun shops and these stores. We need to do this. And so they needed a crisis with which to achieve their agenda, which is taking away the Second Amendment. And now we look at Benghazi. And the evidence has been coming out that the president not only knew about it, but was not allowing protection for our U.S. ambassador after requests for protection, and was transferring troops and protection out and leaving him totally vulnerable. And then there was a drone that was circling, watching all this happening. And, you know, you wonder, gee, was the president aware of this? And then immediately after the killing of our ambassador, the White House sends messages to Google saying, censor all anti-Islamic content. And then the president gets on and gives a dozen speeches saying, it must be this anti-Islamic video. And then Hillary Clinton gives speeches. It's this anti-Islamic video. And then she buys, you know, only 0.5% of people in Benghazi even have access to the Internet. And only, you know, just a couple percentage of people in the whole country of Libya have access to the Internet. So clearly it was not the Internet. And here's Susan Rice, who's being, you know, interviewed before the Senate and for a hearing, and finds out that it was described that she was there in Africa when they bombed our other embassies, I think in Tanzania and some other country, and how this had all the exact symptoms that the other ones had, and how come she was asking for more defense for those embassies and she didn't for this one. And there's lots of questions that look like somebody who's really inept, unless you look at it from the Machiavelli, Hegelian, Saul Alinsky, Karl Marx type of strategy. Now, who has the president surrounded himself with? Who has he put on his staff? People that have been ingrained in this concept. So now, why would they want to have this crisis and blame it on this person insulting Islam? Well, lo and behold, a year ago, Hillary Clinton had been meeting with the 57 Muslim countries in the UN, and they were wanting her to sign on to an anti-blasphemy law that would prohibit all the members of the UN from insulting Islam. And Hillary Clinton's response was, well, we can't do that because we have something in America called the First Amendment. But she said, we're working on ways to get around that. And you think, working on ways to get around that? Well, the strategy is, yes, you have freedom to say whatever you want in America, but if you yell fire in a theater and people get killed, you're held liable. So the strategy is, let's let somebody insult Islam and then have a big crisis and then blame it on that person. And then the day after the Benghazi event happened, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and I don't know what he's doing, still being involved in things, but he sends out a message that that filmmaker should be not only held liable for the ambassador's death, but should be tried for treason and conspiracy. So now we begin to see this was their agenda behind it. They wanted to make anybody that insulted Islam be held liable for treason and conspiracy. This is their way of instituting this agenda. And
it's
just by a miracle that the ambassador's diary was found in the ruins there in Benghazi. And the news reporter said, here, gee, he's asking for support, defense, time and time again. It keeps getting turned down.
So really, this is an attack on freedom of speech.
Right. And you have to understand, in Islam, the sign that you have surrendered is when you agree not to insult Islam. That's the surrender. There is no other surrender. When Muslims, we got 1,400 years of history, and I've written a book called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, History of Islam in the United States. Mm-hmm. I've done two DVDs on Islam. One is called Islamic Conquest, Past and Present, and another is called Political Islam's War on the West. And if anyone's interested, my website is AmericanMinute.com. But Islam conquers huge areas, and the first thing they do when they conquer is they forbid any insult of Islam, of their religion. So we have Egypt. Egypt had been Christian for six centuries, Coptic Christian, evangelized by Mark, that wrote the gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when the Muslims, 10 years after Muhammad's death, invaded Egypt, they proceeded to cut out the tongues of anybody caught speaking the Coptic Egyptian language. They had to smuggle the bones of Mark out of Egypt by packing them under pork. And the Muslims decided that not just was their religion superior, but their culture was. And so they tore down all the temples and the pyramids and robbed the graves. They actually had one caliph had a whole part of his administration that was to rob graves, Pharaoh's graves, and they wanted to eradicate, sort of like they blew up those Buddha statues in the mountainside of Afghanistan, and then just a year or so ago when they rioted in Cairo, they broke into the Museum of Antiquities and destroyed mummies, and there are imams now that are wanting to destroy the pyramids, and anyway, so then we look at Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been a Byzantine Christian city for three centuries, since Constantine. And then we look at Syria. Syria was the first country to completely be Christian, evangelized by Paul. In Antioch, Syria, is where Christians were first called Christian. The name Christian was invented in Syria. And then Caliph Umar invades and conquers. And then there used to be 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa. So today, everything that is Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, and Libya, that used to be Christian. And then the Muslims invaded Spain in the year 711, and in 10 years conquered all of Spain, and then they crossed the Pyrenees, and they conquered southern France, and they were finally stopped just outside of Paris in 732 AD by Charles Martel, exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 AD. They went from Arabia to Paris in 100 years. Now, when they conquered, you had three options. One, convert and become a Muslim. Two, die. Three, be a dhimmi. A dhimmi is a second-class citizen where you can't insult Islam. You can't have a meeting without a Muslim being present to make sure you're not insulting Islam. You can't own a weapon. You can't own a horse. You can't have all these different freedoms. You can't, if your church gets destroyed, you cannot rebuild it. And then you have to pay the jizya. You have to pay an annual ransom of your life. And this is called the dhimmi status. If you or I were to go to Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Afghanistan today, we would be dhimmi. And our word against the Muslims would not stand in a court. We cannot even, in Pakistan, a Christian cannot even go to court. He has to hire a Muslim to represent him because he has no rights in court. It's the dhimmi status. So one of the first aspects of dhimmitude is you can't insult Islam. And so
The $64,000 question here is why is our president setting us up to be in a position where we are losing our freedom of speech and we are becoming subversive to, or subordinate to Islam?
Well, see, from one point of view, it makes no sense. But from the other point of view, he's enacting an agenda. And this agenda is basically to surrender the entire Middle East to the Muslim Brotherhood. Little history.
Treason.
We talk about it.
Treason. Yes?
Well, yeah, to put it bluntly. Within 100 years of Muhammad's death, Muslims conquered from Arabia to Paris. It was the first Arab Spring. Then there was a Turkish Spring, and the Turkish Muslims conquered all the Persian and Arab Muslims, and then they invaded into the Byzantine Empire, which is today Turkey. Then they invaded into Eastern Europe and surrounded Vienna twice, and invaded Serbia and Hungary and Poland and Wallachia, Moldova, and then they controlled the entire Mediterranean for hundreds of years. And that was the Turkish Spring, right? And but after World War One, the Ottoman Empire was destroyed. It was dismantled. And the France took a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Lebanon and Syria. Britain took a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Palestine, Iraq, and later gave birth to Israel out of that. They wanted America to take a part of the old Ottoman Empire, Armenia, and we said no. And unfortunately, 1.5 million Armenians were killed between 1915 and 1922. But the Ottoman Empire was, for all practical purposes, gone. And you have to understand, the British Empire for 200 years had been the most powerful empire on planet Earth. And then America comes along, winning World War One, and then eventually World War Two. And so we had, and so the West is developing airplanes, telephones, televisions, you know, all kinds of advancements. In Arabia, they're still riding around on camels. And so this Muslim world decides that the future is being like the West. And so they get rid of their fundamentalist cousins, and they put in secular dictators. And these secular dictators dress in business suits, and they teach English in their countries, and they send their kids to the West to go to school. You look at a 1950s Egyptian high school yearbook, and the kids look exactly like the Americans. You got the Shah of Iran. I mean, he loved America. I went to school and college with an Iranian student. He had an American flag on his dorm room wall and a picture of the president. I mean, I didn't even have a picture of the president or an American flag when I went to college, you know. I mean, they loved America. And so the Muslim world began to move in this nice Western direction until two things happened. One, the Muslim Brotherhood was started in 1928, and their leadership said, stop trying to be like the West. We got to be back to conquering the world for Allah. But they really didn't get much traction until 1938, oil was discovered in Saudi Arabia. And the West began to finance this spread of the violent version of Islam. And 9 out of 10 mosques in America are financed by Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the number one publisher of Islamic textbooks that teaches, you know, and where to cut off the hand of a thief and so forth. And then I mentioned Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, but he was from Russia, and he understood the Soviet Union, and he said, well, gee, the way to get rid of the Soviet Union is to let Iran fall into the hands of these fundamentalist Muslims, and it will be a thorn in the side of the Soviet Union and help bring it down. And so our policy as America was to pull the rug out from underneath of this secular dictator, the Shah of Iran, and let it fall into the hands of these fundamentalist Muslims. But it's been increasing to where our foreign policy as America has been to pull the rug out from every dictator in the Middle East. And you say, well, they're dictators. Yeah, there's never been a democracy in a Muslim country. Why? Because they have no concept of equality. Allah loves the Muslim, Allah hates the infidel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes two women to testify against one man. There's never been a democracy, except in Turkey for a while, and that's just because Ataturk put the military in charge of making sure they didn't get fundamentalists. But this new president arrested all the military leaders, locked them away, and now Turkey is going fundamentalist. And so we see that right now we have our president calling Mubarak in Egypt saying, step down. Let's have democracy. But democracy in a Muslim country always gets taken over by what I call the Black Panther Muslim Brotherhood, and they institute Sharia law. And then we're pulling the rug out from all these different countries to get rid of their secular dictators. Why? Because our policy has been now to turn it all over to the Muslim Brotherhood. Their goal is to reestablish the Ottoman Empire, one homogeneous Muslim entity that's powerful, and then take the next step of conquering the world. You know, and that's their agenda, and our foreign policy agenda happens to be fitting in with that. Michelle Bachmann, who I know, she's a friend of mine, Louis Gohmert, a congressman, and Trent Franks, they have evidence that Hillary Clinton's assistant, Huma Abedin,
mm-hmm.
has connections with the Muslim Brotherhood. And here Hillary Clinton's our Secretary of State, so here our whole Secretary of State policy has somebody with the Muslim Brotherhood that's either helping it or guiding it or somehow or other. And anyway, so the Benghazi situation, from one point of view, it looks like somebody is really inept. From another point of view, we see that there's an enacting of an agenda. And, you know, we people have agendas and parties have agendas, and, you know, and it just so happens that our president has an agenda, and he's been very diligent in working it.
Wow, my head is going to explode. And it all fits. I mean, and it all lines up with history. It's all right there. Oh, my gosh.
But if anybody's, you know, I've talked about a couple books. One is called Change to Chains. I'll say that slower. It's Change to Chains. And it's the 6,000-year quest for global control. I also have that as an 8-part DVD and then as a book. And then the book on Islam called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, and then a DVD, Islamic Conquest, and then another DVD called Political Islam's War on the West. But AmericanMinute.com is my website.
Very good. Thank you, Bill Federer, for being with us tonight. That was just incredibly enlightening and very informative, and my head is going to explode. It just all falls into place so conveniently. We really appreciate you being with us tonight and
putting
that all
into
perspective.
Well, I will end with this one thought.
Yes.
That it's, you know, I come back to the spiritual looking at it, and that it's in times of crisis power concentrates, but it's also in times of crisis that people turn to Christ. And I can't help but think that through all of what's happening, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to realize that there's more to watching, you know, than watching your nightly sitcom on TV, that they're going to start seeking the Lord, and you know, hopefully we'll have a spiritual revival that'll be sort of like the Great Awakening and help keep the satellite in orbit another generation.
Yeah, one can only hope before it's not too late. All right. Thank you, Bill Federer. Thanks. We hope you'll come back again very soon.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks. Have a great evening.
All right.
Okay. Amazing. So if you have an opportunity to pick up any of that material from Bill Federer, we are going to be hearing a lot more from him in the future. He's just an amazing accounting of what's going on in the Middle East. We really appreciate him being with us. So, Cindy, I want to thank you for being with us, for co-hosting with us again tonight. We hope you'll come back again very soon and do that.
I will come back anytime. And
okay.
Thank you for having me, and I'm with you. In listening to Bill Federer, my head is about to explode. And he connected all the dots Yeah. Made it plain as the hand in front of your face.
All the parallels that are there.
Correct. And, you know, the only question that we're left hanging with is, okay, now we have this information. What do we do with it? How do we
act on it? You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's, you know, the treason is, it's all right there. It's all laid out. You and I are the only ones in the country talking treason.
Yep. So. And it is. It is treasonous. It is treasonous. It's mind-boggling. And, you know, Lisa, in listening to everything as when Bill was talking and even with Bev Earlison, you know, it's like the media is so complicit in what is happening to our country that it boggles the mind. Our media was supposed to be the stopgap from this kind of action on part of our government, and they were supposed to be the whistleblowers, and they have completely failed and have proven themselves to be nothing more than America's Pravda, and that's really sad. And it's up to alternative media like we have here and, you know, conservative talk radio to get the word out and the Internet.
And share
and they're doing everything they can to regulate that, too. So.
Yep, that's true. Okay, I want to thank Cindy for being with us tonight, and thanks to Dave for being with us, and Bill Federer and Bev Pearlson. We will be here again next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, and tomorrow night you'll be here with Kevin Harnett, the Hillbilly Logic, and Friday night we have our Friday evening roundtable, and again, Monday night again with Mr. Hour of Truth, Dave Court. So until that time, visit MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. Send us a few more dollars so that we can help one more family in the Secret Santa Initiative. Sign up for Grass Fire Alerts. We will keep you posted on the latest issues developing as they happen through those Grass Fire Alerts. And look for us on Facebook and Twitter. And until then, we will see you again next week right here at 7 o'clock on Wednesday night for your Culture Vigilante Hour.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.